This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Why did Barack Obama choose Senator Joe Biden as his running mate? Why did Biden accept? What did they agree the role of the vice president should be? And what vice presidents did they model that on? That's the territory covered in the article Biden's Brief in the current edition of The New Yorker. It's written by our guest Ryan Lizza, the magazine's chief political correspondent. For 36 years, Biden has represented Delaware in the U.S. Senate, where he's chair of the Foreign Relations Committee. Biden ran for president in the 1988 Democratic primary and was a candidate again this year before dropping out of the race in January after the Iowa caucuses. Ryan Lizza spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Ryan Lizza, welcome back to Fresh Air. When Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were battling it out in the Democratic primaries, and after Joe Biden left the contest himself, he remained neutral. He didn't endorse either Clinton or Obama. And I wondered, when it came time for Obama to pick a running mate, was it an asset that maybe Clinton supporters might have seen him as more acceptable, since he wasn't someone who had endorsed Obama early and spurned their own candidate, Hillary Clinton?
That's a really good point. I think that Biden was a bit of a bridge to the Clinton world. I mean, you don't want to overstate it, but Biden has had a long and very good and positive relationship with both Clintons. I mean, I would guess, and maybe recently this has changed, but up until recently, I would guess that Biden spoke more frequently to both Hillary and Bill Clinton than Barack Obama did. So the fact that he stayed neutral may have made him a little bit easier to swallow for some of the Clinton folks.
Now Biden is a 36-year veteran of the Senate, serving from Delaware, and has held important positions, chaired the Judiciary Committee, was in all the cultural battles over Supreme Court nominations, and then more recently, of course, has headed the Foreign Relations Committee. To what extent do you think Obama valued his relationships in the Senate as an asset to his administration?
That was something that Biden dwelled on with me at length when I asked him about what kind of role he would have as vice president. He said that Obama has asked him to start thinking about their first 100 days and to start thinking about legislative strategy and to think about the agenda that they would put forth if they win. And obviously that's, very, very important. What pieces of legislation go first? Do you do health care first? Do you do energy? How much do you concentrate on Iraq and Afghanistan? And he says that Obama's asked him to start thinking about that. When I talked to him, he didn't sound like he'd done a whole lot of thinking, but it was still early in the process. And Biden made a couple of comparisons. We talked a little bit about the example of Lyndon Johnson, who another senator turned vice president. And we talked a little bit about Hubert Humphrey, also a senator turned vice president. And Humphrey actually went back to the Senate after he was vice president. Since Biden's been around so long, Biden got to the Senate in 1972, he actually knew Humphrey when Humphrey came back to the Senate. Humphrey was sort of a mentor to Biden, and so he learned firsthand what Humphrey's life was like as vice president.
Well, the Lyndon Johnson comparison is an interesting one because—
Yes, it's not a great one in some ways.
Right. Well, but Lyndon Johnson was, a veteran of the Senate, really understood its relationships and was a power there, was majority leader, and then became vice presidential nominee to a young, charismatic John
yes.
Kennedy. I mean, the parallels are really interesting.
Absolutely. I that's what I thought of as soon as he said it. But what I thought was strange about the fact that Biden would mention Johnson as an example is that Johnson was a miserable vice president. I don't mean he was bad. I mean he was miserable as vice president. He hated the job. His staff and President Kennedy's staff didn't like each other. There was lots of bitterness left over from that election. That the sort of Ivy League, almost snobbish Kennedy aides looked down on Johnson as a sort of Texas hick. And he was miserable in the job. He wasn't, I don't think you could say he was a very successful or powerful vice president. And he was kept out of the loop on a lot of very important decisions. There was a lot of things that were eye-opening to him when Kennedy died and he had to take over. And so Johnson really went from sort of the peak of his power as majority leader to just a sort of depressed, powerless figure in Washington in the vice presidency. Now, things have changed about the vice presidency since then. So it's very unlikely that Biden would have a similar experience. But One thing that Johnson learned was that his influence over his fellow senators changed drastically once he was out of that majority leader position. And so I think that that's one thing that Biden needs to be aware of, is that he's in our conversation, he talked a lot about the personal relationships he had built up over the years in the Senate and how he was going to sort of rely on those to help Obama pass this legislation. On the other hand, there have been vice presidents who came from outside of Washington. Spiro Agnew is a great example. He was probably one of the least effective vice presidents, governor of Maryland. He came in and he tried to make one of the roles he tried to have was to lobby the Senate and to really go up to the Hill a lot and lobby for for President Nixon. And he was resented. He was disliked. Even Republican senators resisted his efforts, and that was partly because he wasn't a member of the Senate club.
You know, as Joe Biden has considered the role he might have as vice president, you note that he didn't want to be a shadow secretary of state, didn't want to interfere with someone who had a line responsibility in the government, and that he understood the Mondale rule, obviously referring to Walter Mondale. What was that?
Yeah, you know, Mondale and Carter really invented the modern vice presidency. Mondale was the first vice president to have an office and staff in the West Wing. And after he and Carter won, Mondale and one of his aides, a guy named Dick Moe, wrote a very lengthy memo, and it almost might be described as the sort of founding document of the modern vice presidency. And this memo sort of described the history of the office, explained why previous vice presidents had been so miserable in the job, and it made a series of proposals for enhancing the status of the vice presidency. And Carter very enthusiastically adopted most of Mondale's proposals. In fact, Mondale didn't even recommend that he move into the West Wing, but Carter did, in fact, invited him in there anyway. And Mondale's chief insight was that to be an effective vice president, you should not saddle yourself with tasks, with commissions, and that previous vice presidents have had done that because the job was so ill-defined and they wanted to have something to do. They wanted to have some sort of job description. So they would run blue ribbon commissions, or they would take on sort of small bore assignments. And Mondale's insight was that that just bogged you down in the bureaucracy and that made you less effective, and that really what you wanted to be is nothing fancier than a general advisor to the president. You wanted to be the last person in the room talking to him. And that was the sort of key insight in the memo that he wrote to Carter in 1976. Mondale and Biden saw each other at the convention this year in August at the Democratic convention, and Biden told Mondale that he had read and studied the memo. So Biden really had done his homework, and in describing to me his conversations with Obama, it was very clear that that's exactly how Biden saw his role as a general advisor to Obama. Now, it doesn't sound like a big deal, but that's how you can actually be more influential.
You know, there was a piece in the New York Times in August when Biden emerged as the nominee by Patrick Healy and Michael Luo, and they said that in this piece that Biden had at times acted as a blunt-speaking provocateur to Obama, challenging the younger politicians' ideas and assumptions. Do you know whether that describes their relationship?
It's something that Obama has said publicly as well. And remember, there's probably no more important issue to Obama's victory in the primaries than the fact that he came out very early against the war. I mean, that was really the crucial distinction between Obama and Hillary Clinton. And I think you can make a pretty powerful argument that if Obama had not been against the war, he wouldn't have prevailed in the primaries. Biden, of course, voted for the war. So on the biggest issue in the Democratic primaries, they were on opposite sides of that debate. You know, there's a lot of ideological consensus in the Democratic Party right now. But when Obama says that he wanted to pick a running mate who would challenge him, it's not just spin. I mean, there is some evidence that that has been sort of Biden's role. And Biden said to me, I mean, one of the stories he told, and I don't think he said it by accident, he said when Hubert Humphrey, his Senate colleague, who had come back from being Johnson's vice president, where he was really abused by Johnson and really had a tough time as vice president, Biden told me the story that stuck in his mind from his conversations with Humphrey was that Humphrey, for the rest of his life, regretted that he had not stood up to Johnson on the war in Vietnam. In fact, Humphrey had become a loyal soldier selling the war to the American public when, in his heart, he thought it was a huge mistake. And when he came back to the Senate and met Joe Biden, he was still haunted by that decision. And Joe Biden told me that's something that he would never forget. He would never forget Humphrey's sort of disappointment in not standing up to his president.
You know, this model of the vice president as an important senior advisor on a wide range of issues in some ways describes Dick Cheney, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, most effective and powerful vice presidents since Mondale have sort of lived by the rules that Mondale set out. Now, of course, Mondale himself did not serve in an administration that was very successful, and yet he's still considered by historians to have been an effective vice president.
You know, one question about the vice presidency, you know, you've noted that a lot of vice presidents have taken on these particular tasks or commissions because the job is so ill-defined and that there isn't a clear role. What about presiding over the Senate? I mean, is that or can that be a big job?
It can. It's interesting. I mean, and you know, in the 19th century, the vice presidency was a bit more of a legislative job. The part of the Constitution that describes the job as the president of the Senate was given more emphasis than the executive responsibilities. I mean, since you know, in the modern era, as the federal government expanded during FDR and then into the Cold War, the vice presidency became much more of a legislative job and much more of an executive position. And then that was really, truly formalized once the vice president moved into the West Wing. You know, so there is some there is a tiny germ of truth to that argument that Dick Cheney tried to make not long ago in one of the lawsuits he was involved in, that he is, you know, the vice president is has one foot in each of those branches. It's a unique position in that sense. And how much time the vice president spends over there in the Senate has really changed. But the guys that have come from the Senate have tended to spend a whole lot more time there. You know, go back to that example of Spiro Agnew sort of getting kicked out of, literally almost being kicked out of the Senate because the senators didn't respect him and didn't want him there lobbying him.
You mean they would ask him to leave meetings?
Well, there was one famous example. I forget, it was a Republican senator who told Spiro Agnew. Spiro Agnew had come up there to lobby him on an issue, and he said, "You can't lobby me on an issue. I'm a member of the Senate. You're not a member of this branch of government." And he said, "I have a new rule. If you ever lobby me on an issue, I'm going to vote the opposite way." Senators, you know, ex-senators haven't had as tough a time as Agnew had.
We're speaking with Ryan Lizza. He is the chief political correspondent for The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Ryan Lizza. He is the chief political correspondent for The New Yorker and has written about Democratic vice presidential nominee Joe Biden. In the latest issue, his piece is called Biden's Brief. You know, I've covered him a bit on the campaign trail, and he is an energetic, impassioned speaker and a natural with people, loves to schmooze and work, you know, diners and bus stops. But you write that his style does not play well in the modern media environment. What do you mean?
Well, here's what I experienced when I was out with Biden, and this was mostly in September. What tended to happen was he didn't have many national reporters following him around. This was the September of when Sarah Palin was all the rage, and he was really the sort of forgotten candidate through most of the time that I was out on the trail with him. There was, I think Pew did a study, and they looked at how much coverage each of the candidates was getting each week, and all through September, Biden never cracked like 6%, whereas Palin, 1 week, was as high as 60%.
That's 6% of 60% media coverage, right.
Exactly, right. All the coverage. So anyway, what was happening is, and I think this has changed just a little bit very recently, but what was happening is that he was mostly gaining coverage only when he made a mistake, only when he made a gaffe. For instance, one day at a rally, you know, he pointed to a local state senator who was in a wheelchair and you know, asked the person to stand up. You know, I thought he did recover well, but Biden is a guy who, you know, political consultants value message control and discipline and repeating the same thing over and over again. And Biden truly prides himself on being available to the press, saying what he thinks, and not being controlled by spin doctors. And so in the modern era, where if you're someone like Biden who is not the story, the only time you're going to break through is when you make a mistake. Very recently, in the last week, I think he started to change that. I think he started to get a little bit more coverage. The campaign has sort of pointed out the sort of glowing local coverage that he's getting. And since the debate, I think he's sort of turned the corner on some of those gaffes that were defining him in September.
You know, the most famous gaffe of Joe Biden's career was in 1988 when he was running for president, and he adopted the biographical story of the British politician Neil Kinnock as his own without attribution, although he had attributed it at earlier moments in the campaign. And that led to a whole series of other stories at which he appeared to have exaggerated his credentials or had apparently plagiarized something, and he had to leave the race. I'm a little surprised the Republicans haven't brought some of that stuff up more in this campaign.
I am surprised, too. And, you know, one of the, to me, what's fascinating about the Biden story is just this cycle of defeat and redemption that he has experienced in his life. He won his Senate seat when he was 30 years old. He was had a beautiful wife, children, had bought a new house in Delaware. And in between being elected and being sworn into office, his wife and 13-month-old daughter were killed in a car crash. So a person at the peak of his profession and then suddenly brought low by a terrible tragedy. He didn't want to serve out his term in the Senate, but was convinced by other senators to stick it out, and of course did, and eventually remarried, rebuilt his life, and became a successful senator. Was talked about from day one as a potential vice presidential candidate, thought about running in 1980, thought about running in 1984, and of course ran in 1988, again at the peak of his profession, a very hot candidate in that election, and then brought low by a plagiarism scandal. He had been running around the campaign trail quoting a British politician. And at a very important debate in Iowa, he quoted the British politician, but unlike other instances, he didn't cite the politician. He used the politician's lines as his own.
And they were very personal. They amounted to Neil Kinnock's family heritage and overcoming poverty, and he essentially told the story as his own, right?
Exactly. So the criticism was both that he stole these lines from another politician without attribution and that the information in the lines did not apply to him. And then that didn't actually force him out of the race, but there were a series of stories that came out in the wake of that, and the accumulation of all the stories made him decide that he had to get out. What was happening at the same time was he was presiding as chairman of the Judiciary Committee over the nomination of Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. And part of his calculation was that if he didn't drop out of the presidential race, the scandals surrounding him were also going to damage the Bork hearings and his ability to stop Bork from becoming a Supreme Court justice. So again, he goes back to the Senate now, you know, with his reputation in tatters, branded a plagiarizer and a fibber. And he's written about this, and he basically spent from 1988 to 2008 rebuilding that reputation. I can't think of a politician who has been around as long as Biden, who has been talked about as a presidential or vice presidential nominee for as long as he has, and has been knocked down as many times as he has, and yet is now at the cusp of becoming the vice president. It's a really remarkable story.
You know, he also has the unique position in this campaign of being the counterpart to Sarah Palin, who is just a unique figure in American politics. And clearly her nomination threw the Democrats off their game for a while. If they attacked her or criticized her, it seemed to backfire. And, you know, I think the conventional wisdom I've always heard from political consultants is that it's always very dangerous to attack a woman in a race. How has Joe Biden handled the challenge of running against, if you will, Sarah Palin?
Well, I think the debate is all the evidence you need to understand his strategy, and it's basically ignore Sarah Palin. You know, one of the rules in politics is that if your opponent is having a tough time and the press is doing all of your work for you, just stay out of the way and let the press do it. There's no reason for you to pounce. And if you look at the vice presidential debate, Biden passed up opportunity after opportunity to go after Sarah Palin. He basically ignored her. And at every turn, he either defended Obama's record, made a positive case for himself and Obama, or attacked John McCain. And in a sense, it was as if, you know, there were pleasantries exchanged between Biden and Palin. But for the most part, he pretended that she wasn't on that stage. You know, I think most people agree that that was an effective strategy. And if the sort of instant polls and focus groups that were taken after that debate suggested that he came out ahead of her.
Well, Ryan, Lizza, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much, Dave. I really enjoyed it.
Ryan Lizza is chief political correspondent for The New Yorker. His article about Joe Biden is in the current edition. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.